Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 1342, Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 16. This is being recorded on August 17th of the year 2024. And once again, it is my pleasure and my great privilege to bring back to our airwaves my new co-host, Monty. And we have been unpacking some extremely unsavory connections going all the way back to World War II and probably before that, and then networking on up through the Cold War, through the Bay of Pigs concatenation, and the assassination of JFK. And as I've said on these airwaves before, and I'll briefly repeat, for younger people, if you want to understand the world you're living in, you must understand two events, and they are inextricably linked. The real story of the assassination of President Kennedy and the real story of World War II, because they're inextricably linked. And if
Amen.
People, oh man, the boy are they ever. And, you know, it is no knock on the many brilliant, brilliant JFK assassination researchers. And they've been featured on these airwaves at great length. To say that they for whatever reason, and again, this is with a huge tip of the hat to them, they don't talk about the Nazi connections. And really, if you're going to talk about what's going on today, you've got to talk about that, because that is so much. When you've got Francisco Franco, the guy in For the Record, 1328, when I read at length on the description for the book, Falange, for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website, that was the Germans setting the stage for Francisco Franco. And you also heard about the Falange in the Philippines. They were heavily networked with Charles Willoughby. So these networks have a huge, huge impact today. And one guy who was an operative within these networks, and who also confided to friends of his that he knew who had killed President Kennedy. He described it as a clique. I would say that was more the operational group. Really, it was a coup d'etat, but it sounded very much like the network that you were just talking about. And then Gary Underhill was found dead on alleged suicide after having shot himself twice in the back of the head with his left hand, despite the fact that he was right-handed. Another one of those, you know, funky CIA-connected, quote, suicides, unquote. You know, Daniel Burroughs we spoke about. And as Roy Frankhauser, who featured prominently in several broadcasts, said about the quote, suicide, unquote, of Daniel Burroughs, bad case of suicide, three bullets. That's what they said, though. So, again, it's just it's just unbelievable. Some of the the lies that we're being asked to accept now, Monty. We've been talking about things again, stretching back to World War II, dealing with China and narcotics trafficking there, moving on up through the present. And as I said, one of the things that's absolutely essential in politics is to follow the money. And when you're talking
about... That's essentially what we're doing here, Dave. I mean, and that's ultimately why I'm describing this biosphere, if I may use that term, of a transnational, trans-Pacific, transatlantic fascists and how they're all interlinked. And for those listeners that may be getting a little bored of Monty and Dave talking about the Kennedy assassination, the reason why it is convenient, at least for me, I can't speak to the 40 plus years of research that brilliant research that you've done, Dave. But ultimately, the reason why I keep on pivoting back to the Kennedy assassination is a matter of simplicity and maybe ultimately a little bit of sloth on my part, even though I don't consider myself a slouch. But it's just simple enough to identify and metastasize, as it were, these fascist networks, these really global fascist networks, because they play such a prominent forward operations role in the murder of the President of the United States of America. And when you understand the murder of President Kennedy. It truly, and maybe, perhaps you can chime in on this concept, Dave, when you understand the networks of the personnel that murdered the President of the United States, President John F. Kennedy, you truly have a snapshot, a crystal clear focusing array snapshot, as it were, of all of the fascist networks that are operating in the United States of America in 1963. I mean, is that a wrong summation of the forces that murdered President Kennedy? I mean, am I wrong in establishing that image, Dave?
No, not at all. It was a coup d'etat, and I often use the metaphor of the JFK assassination as the waste of an hourglass, and it's important to study the sands that are in the top part of the hourglass, and then they fall through the waste of the Kennedy assassination and collect in the bottom of the hourglass. And it's important to understand the players and the grains of sand, as it were, in both halves, both before and after and during. And I don't think one could examine, could exaggerate the importance of the Kennedy assassination very, very quickly. Every president we had for years after the JFK assassination was involved in one way or another. LBJ was deeply involved with the cover-up. Nixon was in Dallas, Texas on November 22nd, 1963 as a lawyer for PepsiCo. When interviewed by the FBI in February of 1964, he said the only time he was in Dallas in 1963 was 2 days before the assassination, despite the fact that the New York Times and San Francisco Chronicle, among other newspapers, had a UPI interview with Nixon in Dallas on November 21st, talking about how hard he was going to work to get rid of President Kennedy electorally. And then, of course, after Nixon.
Real quick, I just want to know, Richard Nixon at the time was acting as an attorney for PepsiCo and Studebaker in Dallas. And I should note that the man that he, that the man that paid for Richard Nixon's lodgings and travel in Dallas, Texas on the I believe it was the 20th of November, 1963, was the president of PepsiCo, Donald Kendall. And ultimately between 1970 and 1973, Don Kendall was a CIA finance officer for the overthrow and assassination of Salvador Allende. So consider that for a moment. Consider that for a moment, that the man that Richard Nixon was meeting with in Dallas was later a CIA covert action finance officer for the coup d'etat against Allende.
And in Watergate, Nixon basically spoke about the whole Bay of Pigs thing, and that was revealed to be a code word in the White House, in the Nixon White House for the JFK assassination. Leon Jaworski was a Warren Commission counsel and also head of the Texas Court of Inquiry, along with Judge Robert Story, who, as Colonel Robert Story passed down the edict that the anti-Nazi, the denazification edict at Nuremberg was to be relaxed. And Leon Jaworski was heavily, more connections than a switchboard. He replaces Archibald Cox, who was Kennedy's Solicitor General, as Watergate Special Prosecutor. And then Nixon, after he resigns, is succeeded by Gerald Ford, a key Warren Commission member, heavily involved with the Rockefeller Commission cover-up. And then after that was Ronald Reagan. Well, no, you have Jimmy Carter for 4 years. He wasn't involved. Then you've got Ronald Reagan, who was not only on the Rockefeller Commission, but also refused to extradite Edgar Eugene Bradley to New Orleans and helped frustrate Jim Garrison's investigation in that regard. And then Reagan, of course, was succeeded by George H.W. Bush, and his links to the Kennedy assassination I talked about in, among other books, Family of Secrets by Russ Baker. So, no, it's not at all inappropriate for you to identify that event as being as important as you have identified it as being. Just look at the effect that had on the post-assassination world. Go ahead, Marvin.
So ultimately, thank you, Dave. Ultimately, I'd like to pick up with, you know, that interesting phraseology of John Garrett Underhill talking about this, Oh, click within the CIA that was involved in narco terror financing and what can I say, a rather lucrative gun running operation. It should be noted that according to the book The War Conspiracy, and this is in the supplemental not the index but the reference section of the book by Peter Dale Scott, he points out, and I'm not too sure where Professor Scott gets this information from, but so essentially listener beware, and if there are any active listeners out there that can help me try to pin down where Peter Dale Scott got this information from, I mean I'd be in your debt, as it were. It should be noted that in 1962, according to Professor Scott, the Attorney General of the United States, Robert Francis Kennedy, brother to the President, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, had initiated an extradition of an American corporate officer whom he had evidence, meaning Robert Kennedy, Attorney General Kennedy, had evidence he was defrauding the United States government. Now, I'd like to make it very clear. Once again, I do not know where Professor Peter Dale Scott got this information from, but he did commit it to print, so I would have to speak at least as a proxy for his reputation in that sense. But according to Peter Dale Scott, in 1962, the Attorney General of the United States requested the extradition of an American businessman in Bangkok whom he felt was defrauding the United States government. Or I should say felt, correction, he had evidence. The Attorney General had evidence that he was defrauding the United States government and trade relations out of Bangkok. And this man was Willis H. Byrd, identified as president of the Sea Supply, Southeast Asian Supply Corporation. Now, the ramifications of that, considering the information I gave in the previous program, Dave, I'm sure do not need to be illustrated. However, I mean, essentially, Robert Kennedy, as Attorney General of the United States of America, was requesting the extradition of General Willoughby's top narco-terrorist gun-running operatives in the Far East. I mean, that's essentially what happened in 1962. Now, according to all ghost stories about Willis Byrd, he never returned to the United States for fear that there were friendly operatives within the State Department and the Justice Department that were still trying to initiate this seizure and arrest of Willis Byrd all the way into the 1970s, believe it or not. So, I mean, I have trouble with that narrative. I mean, I believe that somebody like Willis Byrd could, successfully maneuver raindrops if he wanted to, But ultimately, both President Kennedy and Attorney General, later Senator Kennedy, are in the ground by 1969. So, I mean, I find it fascinating that not only did Willis Byrd outlive both of them, but seemingly, Robert Kennedy was about to arrest him for defrauding the United States government. On what grounds, I do not know. But I'd like to just illustrate once again that as the commander of the Southeast Asian Supply Incorporated entity, Willis Byrd was one of the top narcotics launderers for the Kuomintang's Green Gang intelligence networks during the Second World War. And after the Second World War, effectively, the eyes and ears of General Willoughby's G2 networks in Malaysia and Sri Lanka and Bangkok at the end of World War II. And as I've demonstrated in previous programs, I believe in at least one Patreon program, we have uncovered information indicating that the former chief of G2 for the Japanese during the Second World War, a general by the name of Seizu Arisu, was in fact lock, stock, and barrel. His entire intelligence networks in mainland China were transferred over to General Willoughby's G2 teams as the commander of SCAP, the Supreme Allied Command in the Pacific, and the occupation government, meaning the Allied, meaning General Willoughby's Allied G2 occupation government in Tokyo. Okay? And one of General Arisu's top subordinates running North Korean infiltration operations before the Korean War
is a man by the name of Rear Admiral Yoshio Kodama. That is documented in CIA 201 files from General Arisu's CIA 201 debriefing. I believe it's document number 8 and document number 9. You can look it up not only in Dave Emery's Patreon program, listeners of this program, but ultimately these are documents that can be looked up right on the CIA's archive on General Arisu.
So, and by the way, Kodama Yoshio is an individual whose importance could not be exaggerated. He worked as an army general. He worked as a navy admiral for the Japanese. He was arguably the foremost narcotics launderer for the Japanese. And again, a central operative in the Golden Lily operations. Had a huge personal fortune. I think it was something like 13 billion at the end of World War II. So, I mean, just an astronomical sum of money. And ultimately, he kicked a whole bunch of his money to the CIA, which didn't do his career any, which didn't do him any harm. And I think it was, oh, who was he? He was a cellmate with, I think, was it Yoshida, the top, the first big Japanese Liberal Democratic Party prime minister in the post-World War II period. And he was a cellmate in Sugamo Prison with Yoshio Kodama, and we've spoken about Kodama at great, great, great length. When we get to our pivot.
Kodama, real quick, Kodama was also cellmates with Sawasaka, who was the founder of the Asian People's Anti-Communist League.
So, oh, that's right. You have Reiji Sasakawa. That's who it was.
Sasakawa, excuse me. Sasakawa, yeah.
And both Sasakawa and Kodama heavily involved with the founding of the Unification Church. And, all of the money that went to that appears to have been Golden Lily Father. So again, Yoshio Kodama, a very important individual, and without understanding him, I think it would be next to impossible to really understand the real history of Asia post-World War II. Oh, post-World War II, hell, World War II and post-World War II Asia.
Right. Pivoting back to Gordon McClendon real quick, you know, under interrogation after Jack Ruby murdered Mr. Oswald in the Dallas courthouse, he later stated that his one of his top five best friends in the Dallas-Fort Worth area was a radio talk show host by the name of Gordon Barton McClendon. As I pointed out in the previous program, Gordon McClendon was a G2 interpreter and a propagandist for General Willoughby's G2 intelligence teams in the Pacific, effectively Tokyo Rose's opposite number in American intelligence, all right? There wasn't an American serviceman in the Pacific that had not heard Gordon McClendon's voice. It should be noted as a side, or I should say as an aside to all these military intelligence connections that yes, Mr. Jack Rubinstein, later changed his name to Jack Ruby, did in fact serve in the United States Army Air Forces and later the United States Army Air Force in the interim period at the end of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War. So even Mr. Ruby had some kind of military background, you know, I mean, I should note when we use words like coup, we really mean it, listeners. You know, this was a military operation, the murder of the president. Okay. So moving forward to Gordon McClendon, as I pointed out earlier, one of the converting, fishing trawlers and oil tankers that was used for his Radio Nord anti-communist propagandas off of the coast of the Iberian Peninsula was completely owned and subsidized by Clinton Williams Murchison Jr., Clint Murchison Jr. And purportedly, according to the CIA reports on Gordon McClendon and Radio Nord, quote, unidentified business partners of Murchison that he had in Spain. So ultimately, the entire propaganda radio network that was running Radio Cuba Libre against Castro's forces very early on. Bear in mind, this is pre-Bay of Pigs invasion, 1959-1960, is in fact being subsidized by Spanish businessmen. As a side note, it should be noted that the radio antenna assemblies that were used to broadcast Radio Nord off of the converted fishing trawlers and oil tankers were provided by a company named Ling Temple Vought.
Oh, really?
Yes, sir.
General Dryhole Bird, who owned the Texas School Book Depository Building and was the founder of the Civil Air Patrol, also bought a whole bunch of LPV stock, and LPV was heavily involved with the production of the PFX fighter plane. Were they not, Monty?
Absolutely they were.
So they knew that the Vietnam War would dramatically increase the stock, the price of their stock, and it did. I think General Byrd ultimately had the window from which Oswald supposedly fired and killed John Kennedy from, disassembled and reassembled in his home. So, very interesting stuff.
General Byrd considered it a hunting trophy to get that window frame that Mr. Oswald purportedly fired out of. So, just to give you some idea of his political leanings, yeah. he considered the whole murder of the President of the United States of America a fishing expedition, if you will.
Well, you know, one of the things you were talking about, Robert Kennedy, trying to extradite, which guy was it?
Willis Byrd, of all Willis people, Byrd, Willis yep. Byrd.
Willis Byrd, not Dryhole Byrd, but Willis Byrd. And the more time passes, the more I'm coming to understand the JFK administration and his assassination, not just as a coup d'etat, but he was really trying to, he was framing a rearguard action, and he was trying to reverse things that had been in motion really before World War II, but really got going during World War II and gathered tremendous momentum during the Cold War. Eventually, when we get to our pivot to Asia, one of the reasons that JFK was killed, he cracked down on Syngman Rhee's white terror in Korea. And Syngman Rhee was not only the fascist dictator of what we call South Korea, but he had worked for the Japanese prior to World War II during their occupation of Korea. Just like Nguyen Diem also worked for the Japanese before becoming the de facto slash puppet head of what was then South Vietnam. So, but the more time passes, you know, when I, in 2018 and 2019, Martin, when I did that 25 one-hour series of shows with the brilliant Jim Biagenio about his book, Destiny Betrayed, I hadn't revisited the JFK assassination in some time. I was simply struck by the sheer power of the elements who disposed of Kennedy. I mean, it was like getting, you know, scraping, you know, chewing gum off one's shoe or something. I mean, they just, you know, what? Get out of here, you Kennedy, boom. But quite remarkable. So Ling Temple Vought manufactures the antenna or antennae for Radio Swan.
Radio Nord, in turn, the Radio Swan operations. You know, bear in mind that Richard Greenlee, former OSS commander in Sri Lanka and Malaysia during the Second World War, ultimately one of the founders of the Sea Supply Corp of Willis Byrd, is in fact funding all of these operations, which included, yes, the antennas provided for Radio Nord through the Ling Temple Vought Corporation, of which Clint Murchison, and as he pointed out, Dryhole Byrd, a founder of the Civil Air Patrol and owner of the Sexton Building, a.k.a. the Book Depository. Yes, all of these networks are connected, and they do lead back to Franco's Spain. You pointed out a moment ago, Dave, that ultimately the TFX experimental fighter plane, which eventually became the F-111 fighter plane, Ling Temple Vought and in turn, of course, Murchison and Dryhole Byrd with their investments and purchasing stocks in the events leading up to the eventual mass murder campaign and conflagration that we call the Vietnam War. It was not a war because wars need two sides. What it was a continuity of the Holocaust, in my opinion.
But ultimately, it has to be appreciated that a fascinating continuity of Iberian intelligence operations and the funding of the TFX fighter plane program presents an interesting character. And if I may just expound on him for a minute before I make a dramatic turn to Franco and his Absolutely. Operations in supporting JM Wave. Okay, this is a major general in the United States Army Air Corps Air Transport Command for Mediterranean Theater of Operations. So read into that. That is all of North Africa, the Balkans, Greece, Macedonia, Serbia, Montenegro, and of course, Spain and France. That is the Iberian Theater of Command that this general was in charge of. And from 1943 to 1945, a United States Army Air Corps Major General by the name of Robert James Smith, last name S-M-I-T-H. He was the commander of the United States Army Air Corps Africa Division Air Transport Command. Now, he has an interesting resume. General Smith was at one point the general traffic manager for American Airways. Okay. He was the executive vice president for Braniff Airways Incorporated. He was later president of a company called Pioneer Airlines and later director of Continental Airlines Incorporated. Now, those last two companies are fascinating because according to the CIA files on Civil Air Transport, later Air America, Pioneer Airlines and Continental Airlines Incorporated leased C-47s and C-46 Airbus transports to Civil Air Transport at a time when it was known as an entity as China Air Transport. So why do I mention this? Only in the sense that we're establishing that there is, in fact, according to Gary Patrick Underhill, a clique or a milieu, as it were, within the CIA that is, in fact, profiting very heavily off of the narco-terror trade and gun running, okay? Now, the First National Bank of Dallas was one of the primary loan officers, you know, meaning establishments that was providing loans and securing the loans for the TFX fighter plane program. The other one was the First National Bank of Boston, which was also a CIA front. And the other bank was First Continental Bank of Illinois, of which Michel Sindonia was a finance officer for in the 1950s. You know, a man connected to the Vatican banking scandal and propaganda due.
Yep, and he, along with his successor, Roberto Calvi, were members of the P2 Lodge. Calvi supposedly hung himself beneath Blackfriars Bridge, although it was after a murder. And Michele Sindoma was sent to prison in the U.S. for the collapse of the aforementioned Continental Illinois Bank. Well, there's an Illinois, anyway, Continental Bank. And then when he was transferred to an Italian jail, he died of, they don't know what, he consumed cyanide somehow in his prison breakfast.
Right. So pivoting back, First National Bank of Dallas is in fact one of the loan entities that is providing these massive multi-million dollar loans to General Dynamics and Ling Temple for the production of the TFX experimental fighter, which eventually helped create the abysmal F-111 naval fighter bomber. Now, who is the director of the First National Bank of Dallas, okay, in 1963? Well, Major General R.J. Smith, former commander of Africa Division and Air Transport Command for the United States Army Air Corps, the exact same Major General R.J. Smith that is, in fact, helping create Civil Air Transport and Southern Air Transport, the two entities that are involved and ferrying anti-Castro Cubans into Cuba before the Bay of Pigs invasion. I should note that Major General R.J. Smith was also director of the Dallas Chamber of Commerce in 1963. And as you have pointed out in numerous programs, many Dallas businessmen and
I should say corporate entities were being utilized by the CIA in support of the anti-Castro program. And of course, many of these personalities show up in the assassination of President Kennedy. I would turn the listeners' attention to the Guns of November programs number 3 and 4. Those are excellent resources that talk about the businessmen that are connected through the Dallas Chamber of Commerce to the murder of President Kennedy. I should note also that Major General R.J. Smith, not only was he director of the First National Bank of Dallas, once again providing some of the massive loans to Ling Temco Vought and General Dynamics for the F-111 fighter program, but ultimately, at the exact same time that he was director of the First National Bank of Dallas and director of the Dallas Chamber of Commerce, in 1963, Major General R.J. Smith was also director of the Dallas Council on World Affairs.
Fascinating.
There are two very interesting officers in the Dallas Council on World Affairs in 1963.
Did one of their last names begin with Z?
Well, one of them is a man by the name of Abraham Zapruder.
Yes, indeed. Go ahead. Mrs. Zapruder's baby boy, Abraham. Obviously, it was Abraham Zapruder who took the film that has been referenced in many JFK assassination analyses. One of the interesting things is, had he swung his camera over to the grassy knoll, he could have actually caught the gunman, or at least some of them, on film. But nope, he did not do that for whatever reason.
The other man who was a member of the Dallas Council on World Affairs under Major General R.J. Smith, a finance officer for Civil Air Transport, and the TFX experimental fighter F-111 fighter program is George de Morneschild.
Oh, fascinating. And his brother Dimitri worked for Radio Free Europe, did he not?
Precisely. The same Radio Free Europe program that is subsidizing Radio Swan, Radio Nord, and Radio Cuba Libre. The exact same intelligence phalanx, propaganda intelligence phalanx that Richard Greenlee, Willis Byrd, Thomas Dudley Cabot, Bill Dalzell, and of course Gordon McClendon are all members of, with Clint Murchison in tow, funding their operations with a secret clique of financiers out of Spain.
And by the way, I want to remind people that Clint Murchison, not Clint, but George Monshield was one of Lee Harvey Oswald's intelligence babysitters. Whereas Oswald supposedly had something like an eighth grade education, George de Monville was highly educated, had numerous, he could speak a number of languages, was tied into George H.W. Bush, and he supposedly spied for Nazi Germany in World War II on the Aransas Pass Coast Guard.
Real quick, not supposedly, there is a 1973, CIA memo from Richard Helms. I'll go ahead and publish it in this program that positively identifies George de Morneschild as a Vichy intelligence agent.
And his uncle, Baron Hugo Maybell, was in charge, right, was identified in the book Game of the Foxes by Ladislaus Farrago as being in charge of all Abwehr operations in North America. That's German military intelligence for a time during World War II. So the fact that we find, you know, George de Morneschild, a sophisticate, if ever there was one, hanging out with the ostensibly unsophisticated Oswald is yet another very strange thing.
Right. And I realize that there's an element of, facetiousness and ultimately abysmal sarcasm on your part, Dave. I should note, just for the record, that Mr. Oswald was no fool. He could speak three languages, at least Russian, some elements of Japanese. He could speak rudimentary French and Spanish, according to FBI reports. So he's definitely a linguist. He's a radar technician, which means that he has some understanding of advanced radio telemetry and field telemetry of, particle physics, meaning, how things operate in a vacuum, i.e. aircraft, jet fighters, things like that. And he is, in fact, some kind of photographic reconnaissance officer. Yeah, so because he's working for Jackal Chyrus Stovall in the development of maps for the United States Army's research and publication staff. So, you know, Mr. Oswald is no fool. You know, he is in fact a tip of the spear forward operator of some type. You know, some type of stay behind operative, I would entertain.
He was an intelligence officer for the U.S. military and intelligence community. And, you know, if people think, well, we're reaching for some of these connections, you really cannot separate out the milieu of Dallas on 11-22-63 from what's going on today. One of the things that's cropped up in connection with the ethics considerations for seated Supreme Court justices are all of the lucrative gifts being given to Justice Thomas by, I think his name is Harlan Crowe, who's not only fabulously wealthy, but one of the world's largest collectors, or has one of the largest collections of Nazi memorabilia on Earth. He imprints the son, I think, of Tremelko. Maybe I've got the father and son reversed. But Tremelko built the Dallas International Trademark, which is where JFK was on his way to speak when he was killed. And I believe Clay Shaw was the founder of the entire International Trademark. So.
I'm so glad you pointed it out, because one of the founders and leading officers and friends of Tamil Crowe within the Dallas International Trademark, of course, was Clint Murchison. Okay, father of Harlan Crowe, Tamil Crowe was one of his closest associates in that time period. So let that sink in for a minute.
Yep, the things in the world going to be sinking into the political quicksand that is has been substituted for solid ground on our political landscape. So, continue, Monty. The fascinating concatenation here. And, again, well, we want to bring this back to the financing of Donald Trump's campaigns and so forth. But continue.
Absolutely. So ultimately, it's striking to note that, talking about General R.J. Smith and his, connections not only to Abraham Zapruder, whom, just for a moment, I'd like to segue to Mrs. Zapruder. It should be noted that by trade, he was a dressmaker, as was his wife. In fact, his wife, I believe, was either he or his wife was working directly with George de Mornschild's third wife, who in turn, she was a dressmaker as well. Am I wrong in establishing that?
I don't know. That's the first time I've ever heard that. But
yes, it should be noted that they were, I know for a fact that Abraham Zapruder was a member of the same women's undergarment union of Irving Brown, that in turn, James Thompson, commander of OSS operations in Bangkok, later the president of China International Commerce and World Commerce Corporation Bangkok, which of course had one as one of their subsidiaries, Sea Supply Corp of Willis Bird, were also members of the Lady Undergarments Union. As a very bizarre continuity into Nazi intelligence operations in post-World War II environment, it should be noted that this, the president of the Lady Undergarment Union from 1956 all the way to when he died in 1972 was a man by the name of Carmel Offey, who was the founder of Operation Paperclip and Operation Bloodstone, of which you've spoken of extensively in previous programs.
A veteran U.S. intelligence officer with more connections than a switchboard. His name was Carmel. That's just like the Nakambi, Carmel. No, I guess that's Carmel, Carmel. Last name, Offie, Offie. Very important individual. And I'm glad you brought him up, Monty, because he's a name we don't, that has not surfaced often in these programs. Go ahead.
Well, segueing just a little bit into Carmel Offie, it should be noted, according to the book, The Old Boys by Burton Hirsch, Carmel Offie was in 1963 the Vatican attaché to the CIA station chief in Rome, Italy in 1963, a man by the name of William King Harvey. And talking about the Spanish connections to the establishment of the anti-Castro Cuban networks, the money laundering networks through Paul Helliwell from his OSS station run by Willis Byrd, later CIA station and World Commerce operations through Sea Supply Corp, and of course something called Red Sunset Enterprises. It should be noted that when Theodore Shackley, who replaced William King Harvey as the commander of the JM Wave Station in 1962, when Harvey was fired by, of all people, Robert Kennedy, who was the head of Special Group Augmented. Just to give the listeners a little bit of background, Bill Harvey had sent in an assassination team to kill Fidel Castro in the midst of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Bobby Kennedy found out about it as the commander of Special Group Augmented. Found out that it was an unauthorized operation, something not authorized by the president, and it may have started a thermonuclear war if these men were successful. So ultimately, William King Harvey was fired from his position at JM Wave, and he was kicked out into European operations, where he later became the head of the Rome station, which may have been a failure of judgment on the part of Bobby Kennedy, because that put him firmly in the camp of the propaganda Douay operatives. Ultimately, it should be stated that Carmel Offey, according to Theodore Shackley, who was the man that replaced William King Harvey at JM Wave in the post-Cuban Missile Crisis environment, not only was Theodore Shackley a former interpreter for Reinhard Galen, but he claimed, and I'm trying to find sources on this, he claimed that the CIA spotter program for searching for criminal assets to be utilized for the CIA for covert operations, called QJ-WIN, and ultimately QJ-WIN was an amalgamation of some of the worst of criminal masterminds on the planet at that time. The CIA's QJ-WIN spotter program was looking for people that were experts in smuggling operations, lockpicking, safe cracking, kidnapping, torture, human trafficking, documents forgery, currency counterfeiting, and murder. So these were the people that were being hired through the QJ-WIN program.
Truly a bunch of old Americans. Go ahead, Martin.
Right. According to Theodore Shackley, when he was interviewed by the Rockefeller Commission, incidentally, his pseudonym for his Rockefeller Commission report was Mr. Haley. So you won't find Theodore Shackley in the Rockefeller Commission report, but if you see references to a Mr. John Haley, that is Theodore Shackley speaking, okay? So according to the debriefing of David Belin to a Mr. Haley during the Rockefeller Commission reports in 1975, when David Belin asked Theodore Shackley, a.k.a. Mr. Haley, directly, what does QJ-WIN stand for? I don't understand the two-letter bigram cryptonym. What does it represent? Theodore Shackley, a.k.a. Mr. Haley, told David Belin point blank, the two-letter bigram stood for Spain.
Correct. I remember that. Yes.
So let's read into this real quick. The
Absolutely.
spotter spotter program run by Carmel Offey, the QJ-WIN spotter program run by Carmel Offey, was based out of Madrid, Spain, according to Theodore Shackley. And this is the program that, once again, was not an assassination program, as many JFK assassination researchers have made a mistake about in the past. QJ-WIN was a spotter program that was looking for experts, once again, in smuggling, lockpicking, safe cracking, kidnapping, torture, human trafficking, documents forgery, currency counterfeiting, and murder, okay? That was the scope of the QJ-WIN program.
And once again, this is against the background of the book endorsed by J.B. Vance that lauds Francisco Franco, and quoting him again, we're referring to the Michelle Goldberg column, quote, this is Franco, we do not believe in government through the voting booth. The Spanish national will was never freely expressed through the ballot box, unquote. And the bullet clip, as opposed to the ballot box, is really how things have been done in the U.S. in the years since 1963. Go ahead, Moppy.
Right. Pivoting back to the CIA station chief in Rome, for at least a solid, I'd say going back to the creation of the CIA in 1947, but at least for a solid decade before he became CIA station chief in Rome, William King Harvey had an interesting role within the CIA. He was the commander of something called ZR Rifle, all one word. I'm sure your veteran listeners have heard this referenced in previous programs. But just to give a quick synopsis, ZR rifle was an electronic wiretapping operation that was run by the CIA and the NSA jointly. The NSA officer that was in charge of it was a man by the name of Frank Rowlett. Last name spelled R-O-W-L-E-T-T, Rowlett. And William King Harvey ran his own electronic warfare staff in conjunction with a joint NSA-CIA-ZR rifle program called Staff D, okay? Now, the reason why I bring that up is because when Richard Bissell tasked William King Harvey and the CIA station chief of Luxembourg, a man by the name of Arnold Melvin Silver, to oversee the creation of the QJ-WIN program. Reading again, that's a spotter program, criminal spotter program for the CIA. William King Harvey came up with the brilliant idea of hiding his QJ-WIN program, run out of Madrid, Spain, I might add, inside of the most sensitive communications traffic of the ZR rifle joint CIA NSA program, meaning that all communications regarding to ZR rifle's internal structure were protected by the most sensitive electronic eavesdropping telemetry programs that we had at the height of the Cold War, meaning that none of these programs were committed to print. Very little references are committed to documentation. A lot of this was word of mouth, done over the most sensitive electronics, wiretapping and eavesdropping operations of the entire conflict, run by jointly by William King Harvey and the CIA station chief in Luxembourg, a man by the name of Arnold Melvin Silver, who later became CIA project commander of QJ-WIN. Now, what's fascinating about Arnold Silver and the connection to Madrid, as I've been establishing it not only in the previous program but this program, it should be noted that the chief of the personal staff of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, meaning this is the chief of the personal operating staff of General Lyman Lemnitzer and later General Maxwell Taylor, when General Lyman Lemnitzer is fired by President Kennedy and sent to Europe to become chief of NATO ground forces, which once again was a lapse of judgment because that put General Lemnitzer right in the same camp as Propaganda Douay and Gladio. It should be noted that the chief of staff of the personal staff of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs for two Joint Chiefs chairmen, both General Lyman Lemnitzer and General Maxwell Taylor, was a United States Army Brigadier General by the name of Theodore C. Metaxas, last name spelled M-A-T-A-X-I-S, Metaxas. And after World War II, immediately after World War II, 1945-1946, both at the time Major Theodore Metaxas and Captain Arnold Silver were the interrogating officers for the commander of special operations of the Nazis, Lieutenant Colonel Otto Skorzeny.
Fascinating. And then Skorzeny, one could not exaggerate the importance of Franco's Spain as an operating center for Otto Skorzeny. And indeed, in the great heroine coup, Henrik Krüger, in talking about the Internationale Fascista and the Paladin mercenary group, identified that as sharing an office with the Spanish. He described Skorzeny as basically operating the Spanish intelligence service almost single-handedly. And there was an office of the Paladin group that cohabited with an office of the CIA in Spain.
I need to correct you there. Heinrich Krüger identifies not the intelligence services of Franco sharing an office with Otto Skorzeny, but the Minister of Information and Tourism as sharing the same office as Otto Skorzeny and his Paladin group. I'll read that again. The Minister of Information and Tourism, okay? So essentially, the propaganda minister for Francisco Franco shared an office with Otto Skorzeny in this time period. A very fascinating character, and we'll talk about him in a few minutes once I get over all this QJ-WIN hoopla.
we've got about 10 minutes left in this program, so some of this will have to go into our next show as well. Go ahead.
Oh, sure. Well, he was a man by the name of Manuel Faglia,
Erevan, and I'm sure I'm butchering that last name. His full name is spelled Manuel, middle name, or I should say Spanish surname, reading again, Fraga, Spanish surname, capital Iribarne.
So for Fraga in Iribine.
Irabine, thank you. Fagra Irabine, Manuel Fagra Irabine, who served throughout the entirety of Franco's dictatorship, at least from 1962 to 1990. He served as the Minister of Information and Tourism. Later, he became Ambassador to the United Kingdom, Minister of the Interior, Second Deputy Prime Minister in 1975 to 1976. And founder of an interesting political party, which was a pro-Francoist, quote-unquote, electoral coalition founded in 1976, called the People's Alliance, or Alazán Popular, or the AP Party of Spain. And it should be noted that... as the Minister of Tourism, not only that, the founder of the AP party, but as the Minister of Tourism, he did in fact act as a liaison with the CIA in their travelers' aids networks. Now, once again, I have presented in previous programs, specifically the program in which we talked about the OUN-ABN connections to the DRE, that under the Red Cap Redbird operations established by the former deputy director of plans for the CIA, Richard Bissell, the Travelers Aid legal attachés overseas provided cover stories for stay-behind operatives and terrorists that were being infiltrated into the Eastern Bloc during the Second World War under the command of United States Army security attachés. Now, the army attachés in Madrid, meaning United States Army attachés, acted as intelligence feelers for Spanish military intelligence. So read into that once again. This politician that I just mentioned as the founder of the People's Alliance, who is the Minister of Tourism Information in 1962, Manuel Fraga, what was the last name again on that, Dave? Can you help me out with that?
I think it would be named.
Irabine, Manuel Fraga Irabine, as the Minister of Tourism in 1962, would have been facilitating all stay-behind counter-penetration operations for the U.S. Army attachés in Madrid that were acting as liaison officers to the CIA's rat lines into the Soviet Union. So that is where Otto Skorzeny fits into that. Going back to the QJ Win program under Arnold Melvin Silver, and of course Brigadier General Theodore Shackley, and the aforementioned William King Harvey and Carmel Offey, it should be noted that when Carmel Offey was commander of Operation Bloodstone, he had an attaché that was in the Vatican with him. And once again, I want to thank the late Burton Hirsch for this in his book. Oh, for Pete's sake, by Burton Hirsch. Carmel Offey's attaché was a man by the name of Giovanni Montini, who later became Pope Paul VI.
I was going to say Giovanni Battista Montini. Yes, he was the Secretary of State, and then later he succeeded Pius XII and became Pope Paul VI.
Now, I realize that the source on this is sensitive, but ultimately, and there is some conjecture in this, but ultimately, Ralph Gannis, who wrote a book about Otto Skorzeny's purported connections to the Kennedy assassination, whom I should note that his conclusions I differ with on political grounds. He based most of his narrative off of documents that were purchased from Alexander Historical Auctions. And interestingly enough, these documents are still posted publicly, verbatim,
at the Alexander Historical Auctions website. So, you know, I went ahead and did some digging because you know me, Dave. I'm not content with any one source. I try to back it up with multiple sources. According to the personal letters of Otto Skorzeny in 1950 and 51, he had a meeting with the Secretary of State of the Holy See, and who was also the Deputy of Foreign Affairs of the Vatican. That was Giovanni Montini. And he met with Otto Skorzeny to oversee the financing of a stay-behind army of 300,000 fascist cadre out of Madrid that Otto Skorzeny was ready to turn into a reactionary strike force to go behind the enemy lines to harass the Russians within the Soviet bloc countries. This is documented in his own personal archives.
And Skorzeny used Franco Spain as a base of operation. We're almost out of time, Monty. Just a caveat about Gannis and the Skorzeny papers. Gannis appears to be something of a Skorzeny fanboy, and
right,
concludes that the JFK assassination was a good thing because Kennedy was a communist and was about to be embarrassed by them. He actually described it as, quote, a mercy killing, unquote. And intimated.
Before we end the program, though, on that note, and of course, yes, Gannis is completely full of it, in my opinion. I just want to quote a letter directly from not the Gannis material, but from the Alexander Archives documents on Otto Skorzeny. This is a letter dated 24 February 1952 from Otto Skorzeny. From Hamburg to Monsignor Montini, Deputy of Foreign Affairs of the Vatican, okay? And this is a direct quote from the letter. Quote, this is Otto Skorzeny speaking to Montini. Quote, I feel the responsibility in the name of political refugees and Germans living in Spain to thank the Holy Catholic Church for their generous and warm acceptance of the above-named received from Franco's Catholic Spain. We are all very blessed to ensure your High Excellency that practically all of those refugees are from Spain. We are blessed in their hearts and truly thankful towards the Holy Throne for protecting said refugees.
Well, signed, isn't that, guys?
Signed Otto Skorzeny, quote, allocation of papal donations for German refugees in Spain, year 1949. Now, clearly,
we're almost out of time, Bobby. Go ahead.
Clearly, Giovanni Montini is a finance officer for these Nazi rat lines established by Otto Skorzeny, not exfiltrating people out of the Soviet bloc, but sending these fascist cadre into the Soviet bloc once again through the information ministry and the tourism industry of Franco in 1962. Okay. And since we're out of time, we're not going to be able to pivot into that infrastructure's direct connections to the Trump campaign in 2016. But I'm sure we'll pick up at that on a later program.
We will indeed, because people think this is long ago and far away. Well, it may be far away, and
no,
it may
no,
seem...
No, no, in fact, I will demonstrate in the affirmative that there are direct connections between the financial networks of these Nazi gladio rat lines run by Skorzeny and William King Harvey, but these connections go directly to the Trump campaign in 2016 and later in 2020. Direct structural connections.
And we will talk about that. However, we're going to wait for our next pair of shows to do that. This concludes For the Record program number 1342, Conversations with Monty. This has been conversation number 16. This is being recorded on August 17th of the year 2024. For Monty, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.